This is Edward October, host of October Pod on YouTube. Hear that jingle jingle? It could be Kris Kringle, or a home invader looking for an open window, a jilted lover looking for revenge, or a disgruntled co-worker hoping to spike your eggnog with arsenic. The girls of our true crime podcast are always on Santa's nice list, but the crimes they discuss are very naughty indeed. Listener discretion is advised.
Hi, Jen.
Hey, Cam. How are you?
Oh, you know, this is it, right? This is a big one. The biggie. The finale.
Not only is it the very last Nightmare Before Christmas on day 12, but it's also the last OTCP episode of 2020.
Hey, does that mean, are we starting our, let's see, third season, fourth season? I like to say that it makes us sound professional.
Seasons? Sure.
Season. Our third season has now concluded, and please join us on January, what day is it, 16th, 12th, 14th,
13th.
Whatever.
I believe 13th, we will be
January
back.
13th, for an all-new, exciting season 4 of our True Crime Podcast,
exactly.
Where we will bring you very special episodes.
Exactly. So we will be back on January 13th. We were going to do the first full week back, but the very end of January, right, or the very end of December, I should say, right before New Year's Eve, I get to have oral surgery. Woohoo! So we're scheduling it a week later just so I can speak. So anyway, yeah. Should we start?
All right, well, I'm excited. I say let's do it.
All right.
Let's do it. We've been waiting for this for a while. Let's go.
Like I said, it's the very final episode of 2020. And so far, we've traveled back in time and we've gone to other countries like the UK. We've been to Australia and Japan. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But this final episode, Cam and I are actually circling back, and we're going to do a case that's been in our own backyard.
I don't know this. Do I know this?
You know this.
I'm excited.
Oh, you know this. So today, we're going to be discussing the St. Louis murderer and suspected serial killer, Maury Travis. Maury, like I said, is suspected of killing between 12 and 20 women. He was only for sure charged on 2.
Wow.
And 6 of those victims have ever been identified.
I do know this guy. He is the worst worst.
I knew how creepy he is, but just reading. And I want to say huge thanks to the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, the newspaper here. I got all the information from newspapers.com. They did such a brilliant job on documenting the whole thing from beginning to end. Mm-hmm. There's not much that we know about Maury Travis when he was a young man. All we know is he was born on October 25th, 1965. His parents were Sandra and Michael Travis, and they lived in the Carr Square public housing complex just northwest of downtown. 10 years old. Maury and his family moved to Ferguson, which is about 20-minute drive from the St. Louis Arch. And I'm sure many of you have heard of Ferguson. Back in August of 2014, there was the shooting of Michael Brown by police officer Darren Wilson. And this sparked what is now called the Ferguson Unrest or Ferguson Uprising, protest or riots. You can find them all through. Mm-hmm. It was scary, and we live maybe 20 minutes from where it all happened. It was pretty scary time.
I would say, and I could be wrong, and our listeners can correct us, but I think this was kind of the cusp. This was right at the beginning of the Black Lives Matter. And
right, it was.
The police officer shooting unarmed.
Talking about police men. Should be demilitarized and all sorts of stuff. But we aren't here to discuss that. That is a very hot political topic.
That's another podcast.
It's a hot political topic, and we don't do political topics here at OTCP. We try to stay uninvolved. Not personally, but on the podcast we do. But anyway, yes. Let's get back to Maury, shall we? One of Travis's neighbors in Ferguson described him as being very quiet and very respectful as a young boy, and she knew him by the nickname of Toby, and that's how his mother and his family members, and how they got Toby out of his name. It was Maury Troy Travis was his name, full name, but he was gone. He went by the name Toby. On occasion, she said that he would, like, come mow her lawn unasked, do nice little chores around her. Oh. And the quote was, "I don't believe he could kill a fly."
Well,
other people that have lived in the neighborhood don't remember him at all.
Yeah.
So, and this is the same with the kids he went to high school, the same kids that he went to class with every day. Records show he was a student at McClure High School in 1982 and up, yet there's no photos of him in the yearbook. One teacher remembers him, and she described him as, quote, "a very quiet and withdrawn, incredibly quiet for a teenager." And she said, "even the quiet ones can be noisy sometimes, but not him." Records also show McClure School shows that he did receive his diploma in 1985 when he was 19 years old. Maury then served 2 years in the Army Reserve, and he worked as a medical and dental assistant. And he also worked for various local trucking companies and even volunteered at a nursing home. So he seems like a good kid, right?
I mean, yeah, you know, a lot worse out there, right?
At 22, Travis enrolled at Morris Brown College in Atlanta. He picked up some computer skills. And I mean, this is what, early 90s, so the computers were just starting to come around. And it was there Maury would become addicted to cocaine, or rather, crack cocaine. And later he would say that he had a $300 a day habit.
Wow.
Now, from the American Addiction Center's website, cocaine is a hydrochloris.
Uh-oh, we got some medical terms in here.
Cocaine is a hydrochloride salt in its powdered form, while crack is derived from powdered cocaine by combining it with water and another substance, usually baking soda or sodium bicarbonate. Now, after cocaine and the baking soda are combined, the mixture is boiled and formed into a solid. Once it's cooled and broken into smaller pieces, these pieces are sold as crack. So the name crack derives from the crackling sound that's produced when the drug's heated and smoked. And according to the Center of Substance Abuse Research, since crack is highly concentrated, it is extremely addictive. Now, that is from all those websites taken verbatim, because basically the only thing I knew was crack takes effect quicker and it's cheaper.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know,
I just remember it as,
that's it.
You know, they always have epidemics, like the drug of the time epidemic. And I remember when we were in high school, it was like the crack epidemic. And we're like, oh, what is that?
Because,
you know, we were like little kids, but it was all over the news and made the cover of Time and Newsweek and all that
stuff. Oh, yeah. And one of the big insults was your mom's on the crack pipe and stuff. Yeah. I mean, it was a big.
Oh, yeah.
Like those yo mama jokes. Yeah. It was huge. Spring break brought Travis back to Ferguson in 1988. And that's when he started having serious run-ins with the law. Why? Travis needed cash to support his drug addiction, so he robbed 5 shoe stores in a period of 5 days.
Yikes.
The St. Louis County detective who arrested Travis said, quote, "he was respectful and quiet and reserved. He wasn't your typical type of criminal." In January of 1989, Travis pled guilty to the robberies, and 6 months later at his sentencing, Travis told the judge how he had gone through rehab and he was now clean. Quote, "I got all that stuff out of my system," he said. One of the documents in Travis's court folder, this is kind of fun, is a letter from former United States Rep. William L. Clay. And, you know, it's written on all the big fancy government letterhead and the stationery. And he wrote the court and asked them to show leniency for Travis. Quote, "I have known Mr. Travis and his family for a number of years. And I feel he is deserving of special consideration in this matter. Since 1988, Mr. Travis has conducted himself in such a manner as to pose to no threat to society. I am pleading that he be given leniency and probation with the condition of voluntary service at a charitable community agency. Right? Best part?
Uh-huh.
After Travis was arrested for murder, media went and they asked Clay about the letter. And he's like, oh, God, I send thousands of those letters.
I knew. Uh-huh. Yep.
And I don't remember Travis or his family at all.
Yeah, I don't know. Mm-mm. Nope.
Yeah. So what? Yeah. Anyway.
Maybe you should be a little bit more, you know, picky about letters.
That's probably maybe why he's something. Former rep. Anyway. Travis was sentenced to 15 years in prison. And within 2 months of being at the Farmington Correctional Center, Travis wrote the judge and asked him to please reconsider his sentence. He wrote about the rapes that went on, although he didn't say that he was raped. Just the...
In the prison?
Prison rapes in general. Yes.
Oh. Uh-huh.
He wrote about the tight living quarters, about how the food was a bad quality, and how it was so easy to get drugs. Yep. Sounds like prison to me.
I watched 60 Days In, and let me tell you, you're not supposed to be comfortable in jail. No. Also.
I mean...
I could never do jail time. Mm. I'm too pretty and too... Here's the one thing. Let me just... tell you right now, they don't get a pillow. I was like, oh, I could do it. And then I realized they don't get a pillow. They get a blanket. And I'm like, nope, I'm out. Plus, I have bad feet. So I need good arch supports. And they don't get that either. So I'm out. I can't do my prison time. Okay, go ahead.
Here's part of the letter. It says, quote, the condition here are excruciatingly tormenting, to say the least. Staying in my cell and crying myself to sleep most every night will not help, but it is so very hard to believe this has happened to me. The whole situation is horrid and phantasmic. If it weren't for such a caring cellmate, I'm sure I'd committed suicide after my first day here in this institution. Travis basically asked the judge to get his 15-year sentence to be replaced with a 120 or 180-day shock imprisonment, whatever that is. I have never heard what that is. I don't know. Do you?
I don't know either.
Of course, I don't think the letter worked, but Travis was paroled on June 4th, 1994, after only serving 5 years and some odd months. Travis would actually be sent back to prison 2 or 3 more times for having drugs on his person, which, of course, is a violation of his parole. So that's all we know so far about his past.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So we're going to go into the murders. On August 6th, 2000, the St. Louis paper ran an article titled, quote, Neighborhood Worries, But Police Aren't Ready to Say Serial Killer, after the body of 61-year-old Mary Shields was found in East St. Louis.
She's 61?
She was 61. Mary Shields was found lying on her back with only a pair of ripped, blood-stained underwear on. Yvette House, 33 years old, was found on February 2nd of that year. Her body had been there possibly a month or so. She was almost skeletonized. There was a crack pipe and a lighter found close to where her body lay. Another woman, Cerise Johnson, was found in a trash bag, nearly nude. She was found within 24 hours of being dumped. On May 18th, residents reported a dog walking around with what looked like a human leg bone in its mouth. When police investigated, they found 2 trash bags, each holding the bones of one had 31-year-old Ramona Sidney and the other had 38-year-old Tracy Williams. All these women frequented the Princess Motel. That's the
in East St. Louis.
In East St. Louis. Now, East St. Louis, yeah. I go into it later. East St. Louis is right over the, is it the Chains Rock Bridge to go into St. Louis,
yeah.
Right? Or
yeah.
And it's in Illinois. It's not really in St. Louis. So Louis Haywood, who not only worked at the motel, but he also lived there, said that the Princess Motel had a reputation as a haven for sex workers and drug users. And he said, quote, they'd, the victims, come here with every type of man, black, white, red, green. I'm going to say he's probably lying. I have never seen a red or green man, but that's different.
Green? Martians? Yes, you have gin?
And this really...
Wait, Martians was really... I'm sorry. That was racially mean against people from Mars.
Sorry.
Aliens.
Well, we're all inclusive here. We love everyone.
That's what I'm saying.
And I'm only mentioning this right now. And a lot of the things that I've found on Maury Mary Shields is mentioned as being a possible victim of Maury Travis, but it's never been proved. These other women have not been claimed. But I just thought it was interesting because it was around the same time Travis was supposedly killing his victims. And I just thought it was interesting. And also, there's an article from April of 2019 from St. Louis's public radio website stating, and it stated that there were 341 unsolved murders in East St. Louis between 2000 and 2018.
And that is shocking. No wonder St. Louis is always at the top of the murders in the United States. And that is only unsolved. That's shocking to me.
I just wanted to include Mary Shields. It's technically not who the police suspect, but it's suspicious. Okay. I'm just going to say it's suspicious.
As we always say on the show, seriously, these are who you know and who we suspect. And then there's how many that he really did.
Right.
Or they did. Or she really did.
It could be more. Honestly, his victim profiles, he killed black sex workers that usually were addicted to drugs because he was addicted to drugs. So
plus it made them weak in the sense that they couldn't really, they needed the money they needed, right?
Now we're going to start into the case where really known or police suspected victims for Maury Travis. He's an asshole. All right. Anyway. A nude body of a woman was found in a ditch in Washington Park, right across the Mississippi in Illinois, on April 1st, 2001. According to the website newspaperscout.com, reading it verbatim, by the way, Washington Park has a crime rate of 36 per 1,000 residents. Washington Park has one of the highest crime rates in America compared to all communities of all sizes, from the smallest towns to the very largest cities. One's chance of becoming a victim of either violent or property crime here is 1 in 28.
Wow.
So basically, you only go over there if you want to buy drugs or buy sex. Through fingerprints, the body is identified as 34-year-old sex worker Alyssa Greenway. She had ligature marks on her wrists and ankles. Eric Hickey of Serial Murders and Other Victims said, quote, being a prostitute increases your chance of being murdered 200 times. And he says, with killers, perhaps coldly calculating that, quote, they're easily disposed of and they're not going to be missed. Hickey believes that the police won't look as hard for these missing sex workers as they will for more, quote, respectable victims. That's sad, isn't it?
Well, these are people's lost. And plus,
daughters. I mean, it just...
But often they have a drug problem and they disappear on the streets and their loved ones are used to not talking to them, but maybe once every several months. So it's an easy target to make them disappear. You know what I mean?
Well, one of these victims, the police had a problem identifying because she did not have any family, at least in the area. And they had to rely on what other sex workers told them about the woman. I mean, it's just, it's heartbreaking. Anyway. Police were able to trace Alyssa Greenway's last location to St. Louis, but nothing further. Alyssa was a known sex worker with a drug addiction, and she would normally work the areas of East Grand and Broadway. It's several miles from
We know exactly where that is.
Several miles from the Baden area where she lived. A lot of these workers were from the Baden area.
Well, there's the Stroll.
Yeah.
Right? So, and... He knows that.
He lived only 15 miles away from there.
Yep.
On May 15th, 2001, off of Highway 67 near West Alton in St. Charles County, Missouri, a nude body of a woman was found in a ditch. The body was badly decomposed, so getting a fingerprint was near impossible. When the body was taken to autopsy, inside her mouth, they discovered a dental plate, and on that dental plate had the name Wilson. Now, it took some time, but with that little piece of information, they were able to identify the body as 36-year-old Teresa Wilson. Teresa was also a sex worker who worked in the Baden, North Broadway area, and she was also a known cocaine addict. In North St. Louis, body of 50-year-old Betty James was found strangled in an alley on May 23rd. She, of course, like the others, was a sex worker, and she had drugs in her system. When examining her body, police found tire tracks on one of her legs, around the shin and calf area. As awful as it was, Maury ran over her, but this, at least, was more clues than he had ever left in the past, right? They were able to get a lift of the tire tracks from her legs. 5 weeks later, 36-year-old Veronica Ronnie Thompson is found only 16 feet from where Teresa had been discovered. Ronnie was also a sex worker and had drugs in her system, and she was last seen on June 23rd in the Baden area. St. Charles County Detective Jana Walters, smart cookie, she knew, two bodies, same area, same, you know, situation going on, something was up. She was smart, so she started to contact other police agencies around St. Louis and the surrounding areas, just asking by chance if any other bodies had turned up that was about the same, anything familiar. Lucky for her, Agent Jimmy Walker with the Illinois State Police contacted Jana Walters, and he's the guy that had been working on Alyssa Greenway's case. Mm-hmm. They got together and started sharing notes. Around this time, Travis is working as a waiter at the Mayfair Hotel in downtown St. Louis. And one of his co-workers recalls talking to Travis about a friend whose car had been stolen and found torched in East St. Louis. Travis looked at him and said, you know, East St. Louis was a good place to dump things because, you know what, there's not many police around. And if they're not paying attention, the bodies of at least four of Travis's suspected victims were all found in the East St. Louis area.
I wonder if he just thought, I mean, obviously he thought they were throwaways, right? But did he really think that he could just take human life, go over there and dump it, and nobody would follow up with that?
Obviously, some of these remains were just skeletons. Like, they had been just gone for 6 months to a year.
Shame on him.
There's also the same guy that he worked with had a woman that worked at was dating a woman or engaged to a woman that worked at a local TV station here, and they claimed that Travis told them that, you know what, you guys should really do a show on all those missing sex workers. And then when they found out all this happened, they were kind of shocked that he even knew enough to say about it. So now things were starting to come together, and the St. Louis Police Department decided that they were going to form this multi-jurisdictional task force. They could no longer deny that, you know what, there is a serial killer in the area. Captain Harry Hegger was put in charge of this task force. So months go by, and they comb the streets. They're talking to other sex workers, trying to see if anybody remembers these women, if they happen to remember the last client, or John, or that these women were with, or they're just asking everyone, you know? Mm-hmm. Everybody that was looked at needed to be looked at. No information was found. Everything's quiet over the summer. Nothing happens. Until August 25th, 2001, when 50-year-old Yvonne Cruz was found in East St. Louis. She had been strangled. At the autopsy, they found that she had a cocaine in her blood. But, bingo, the killer had also left semen inside her body. This was quite a find. I mean, never has any of these bodies had any type of DNA on the bodies whatsoever. So September comes and goes. Remember, 9/11 happens this year.
Mm-hmm.
And police have run the DNA profile through CODIS, or the Combined DNA Index System. And
I love that.
CODIS, and in case any of you don't know, CODIS enables federal, state, and local forensic laboratories to exchange and compare DNA profiles electronically, therefore linking serial violent crimes to each other and to known offenders. And I want to say thank you, FBI.gov, for that info that I just lifted off your website verbatim.
You didn't lift, Jen. You borrowed it and you shared with the world.
Like, I could put those in my own words. Yeah, I don't have them words to do that. But needless to say, after running it through, they had no matches. On October 8th, 2011, the body of 33-year-old Brenda Beasley was found in East St. Louis. Again, Brenda worked at Hardee's, and she was also a known cocaine user and also involved in sex work. Hold on. Police discovered that she, too, had semen in her body. When they do a profile on that DNA, they found that it is a match to the DNA on Yvonne Cruz. So bingo, they've got someone out there that has at least killed, that they can link to kill two people. Mm-hmm. Pretty exciting.
Well, and at that point, you know that they're thinking, ooh, well, he did two. How many more?
Exactly. It's all the same MO. Yeah, we got ourselves one of them there serial killers. Since there wasn't a match to the DNA in CODIS, police start to take samples from local suspects. Now, this is a very slow, arduous process, and unfortunately, nothing is ever found. Nothing comes about
it. It's not a TV show. I think that people think that, you know, like on CSI or those other shows, it's like, and then the results came back. Often it's 9 months, year and a half. I mean, it's some time.
Yeah, like, I believe just trying to find who the Teresa White was took at least 2 or 3 months just trying to figure it out. The sheriff had to go door to door to different dentists, you know?
Right.
I mean, it's not easy work. It's a lot of footwork. Now, since the beginning of all of this, bodies had been found every 5 to 6 weeks. But since Brenda was found, the bodies stopped. No more remains were found through the rest of the year. And the police force theorized that maybe the killer was in military and had been called up due to 9/11.
Oh,
or maybe
yeah.
He had been put in jail.
Oh,
I'm going to say, ding, 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 ding. Somebody had drugs on their body and broke their parole. But that's easy
two,
for
Bob.
Me to say because I know this story. In January and March of 2002, 3 unidentified skeletons are found in different areas in Illinois. And at the time, police don't connect them to our serial killer here. So no new leads or bodies. Police are at a loss. They don't know what to do. It's stalled. The case has gone cold. In May, Bill Smith from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch writes an article focusing on Teresa Williams and the other women whose bodies have been found. In fact, like I said earlier, I got a lot of my info on this case from his articles, and another one by the name of Bill Bryan wrote a bunch of good stuff on it.
Mm-hmm.
In these articles, Bill Smith humanized the victims. He showed the public that they were more than sex workers. They were more than drug users. They were actually women that had family and friends that loved them. And they were human, basically. 5 days after the article was published, Bill gets a letter. And the letter says, quote, "Dear Bill, nice sob story about Teresa Williams. Write one about Green Wade. Write a good one, and I'll tell you where the others are to prove I'm real. Here's directions to number 17. Search in a 50-yard radius from the X, and then put the story in the Sunday paper like the last." And with the note...
I bet he was...
Can you believe that?
No!
And with the note was a map that had been printed from a computer. So, of course, Bill does what any good, normal human does. He tells the police, you know, he turns over the note and the map to the cops, and boom, they go out immediately and they follow the map to where the letter writer said that the body would be. And sure enough, bam, human remains.
Wow.
They found the body at one part and the skull like 50 yards away from the others.
So then they for sure knew that the letter writer
was serial killer. Yeah, they knew.
Yeah, he was not a... He wasn't some...
He at least knew where the body was. They thought they knew it was a killer. And they were happy. They were close. They were going to catch the serial killer. It's the first... I mean, they hardly had any clues. And then, bam, here's this letter that basically proves that he's there. And then there's another victim for him. So the police are now... they're going to catch it. They know they're going to catch the serial killer. And they go over the letter and the map. And they're trying to find clues. They're trying to find DNA. They're... trying to look at this, you know, there's nothing. They looked at the paper. The paper wasn't special. It couldn't be traced anywhere. They were stumped. And then somebody looked at the map and they're like, okay, it's been printed at the computer. And you know, when you print something from a website and you know, at the top and bottom, and it has like the little URL and all that kind of stuff, that had been chopped off, right? So it was just, he cropped it basically. What they did is they sent the map to the Illinois State Police Cyber Crimes Unit. And then when they picked it up, they're like, huh, yeah, it looks like it's been printed from Expedia.com. Right? Okay.
Hey, buddy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I print off Expedia all the time. Yeah. Oh, that looks like a Google map. Anyway, it was recognized. So what they did is the state police called Expedia, and they were able to get a log of every computer that had logged on and used those coordinates that where the body was found. That's amazing, isn't it?
Isn't that amazing? I was just going to say that.
And then through that, they were able to get the IP address of the computer that did it all.
Right.
And like that, within hours, they were on their way to meet their serial killer, Maury Travis.
I hate to say this, but I almost wish that people would not have come forward and let all of us, regular people, know what computers can do. Because remember, BTK was caught the same way. You know what I mean? And that, I don't know.
But seriously, who would have ever thought that you would print out something and somebody would go, oh yeah, they got that from Expedia. That's because it's a certain style, I'm assuming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know? Mm-hmm. It's just...
I don't even know if Expedia is still around.
Isn't it? I just think it's a travel place now, isn't it? Expedia.
.com. I used to buy plane flights when I lived in California from there. But yeah, I don't know.
Isn't like William Shatner, the spokesperson there at one point was...
He said Expedia. I don't even remember.
I don't remember.
I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah, me neither.
It's 7 a.m. on June 7th, 2002. With a search warrant in hand, police banged on Maury Travis's door. Travis opened up the door wearing only his underwear. He didn't seem surprised to see the police at his door at all. The only thing he did was said he just asked them why they were there so early. One officer said, well, you know why we're here. And Travis nodded. Mm-hmm. He invited them inside and he got dressed. And then he spoke with the officers. And the police said that his home was, quote, normal. And it was very clean and organized.
Upstairs.
Thank you very much. And as they talked, Travis's calico cat walked through the room, visited each officer.
He had a cat, too.
And he had a cat. And one of the investigators reached down to, like, pet the little cat. And they said that Travis kind of stiffened up and kind of moved to the edge of this couch. He didn't like that the police officers were, like, petting the cat or having any attention, giving attention to the cat, which
Why?
I find is kind of weird. I don't know. Oh. And then when the cat got close enough to Travis, he picked it up and placed it next to him and, like, would pet
Control?
It.
Control.
Didn't want to share it.
No, I mean.
I just found that was, it was in an article, and I just found that
very telling
weird.
If you're paying attention. You know what I mean?
Yeah. It's just, it's
odd.
So
I thought maybe you were going to say that the little kitty cat had blood on him or something, but no.
Oh, no.
That's almost even worse, that the fact that he is controlling.
This is my cat. You can't
exactly.
touch it. So for 2 hours, the police tried to ask Travis questions, but he would just redirect his answers. Like, part of them was like, where'd you grow up? And Travis would volley back with, where did you grow up? Could you imagine how annoying that would be? It'd be like talking to like a six-year-old. I don't know. I know you are, but what am I? Travis wanted to be in control. He never asked why they were at his house. He never admitted to anything, nor did he deny anything. The only thing he wanted to know was how he got caught.
Of course he did, because he's an asshole.
And when he was told about the map, Travis said, quote, expletive computer, damned internet. And expletive computer was actually the quote.
I was like, why are you not saying
expletive
that? But okay,
was
I got
in,
you.
Yeah. No, expletive was in quotations. So this is a PG-rated thing, a PG-rated podcast and
Most
newspaper.
Times.
Travis agreed to go downtown to police headquarters to be questioned, and while they were out of the house, while they got Travis out of the house, forensics came in and searched. And down in the basement, it's not as clean and tiny like the upstairs, like you said, not as clean as tidy.
Yep.
Police found a secret torture chamber with bondage equipment. They found a stun gun and newspaper clippings about the murders that he was suspected of committing. They also find some blood spatters in the floor and on the ceiling and on the walls. Some of the bondage equipment also had blood. They also find a videotape.
Here we go.
Was labeled Your Wedding Day. Now, granted, an hour and a half, I think, or something like that, I think I read. I didn't write it down. It was basically a wedding. It was a wedding. But after that, it showed Travis basically tying these women up and him torturing them and raping them. And some of these women were lucky and they got to leave his house, and others weren't so lucky. I've seen parts of these videos. Most of them haven't been released. I'll put links at the bottom where you can kind of see a little bit of them. They're very disturbing. And Merry Christmas. I'll let you go find those on your own. But one scene showed Maury Travis wrapping a belt around the neck of a nude, kneeling woman. She's handcuffed and she's bound with rope. And then you see Travis pulling the belt tight. And after the woman goes limp, as she's dead, Travis pans the video over the body and says, quote, "This is first kill number one. This kill was 19 years old. Name? I don't give a F. First kill was nice."
Nice, buddy, nice.
And then there's one video tape where the woman is crying and he makes her repeat over and over, "You are the master.
Yes,
it pleases me I've to seen serve that one. You." Mm-hmm. And there's another one that he's like, "Are you sorry you did this?" And she's, "Yes, I'm sorry." And he goes, "What would you tell your children? Would you tell your children I'm sorry?" And she's like bawling and she's like, "Yes, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry." It's heartbreaking, heartbreaking. And I hate it. Travis would hold these women for days and he would physically and verbally abuse them. And like I said, you can find some of the audios online.
But don't.
There are
it's
some
terrible.
Still pictures.
He is a sick mofo, for real.
Right. But like I said, Merry Christmas. I'll post the links. You can find them on your own. Just say that the tape was so disturbing that police chief Joe Mokwa ordered psychological counseling for every officer who viewed them.
Brutal.
Police said that during the interview, Travis seemed to show genuine affection and concern for only one person, his mother. They questioned Travis for over 8 hours, and they never saw him show any kind of remorse. And at one point, Sergeant Tim Sachs brings out some photos of the victim, and he said, "So, hey, yeah, Travis, you know these people?" And Travis, of course, denies knowing who they were. And, you know, of course, he's never, "I've never seen those ladies in my life," right?
Of
never,
course.
Right? A few minutes later, Travis would say, "Can I see the pictures of those dead girls again?"
Because he's sick.
Yeah, but Sergeant Sachs had never said that they were dead.
Yeah, well.
Because they were actual pictures of the women when they were alive.
Mm. Very telling now, isn't it?
And then, yeah, exactly. Ding, ding, ding. And at one point during the interview, the police were saying something to him and Travis just kind of like drops his head and is like, "I'm toast. I'm toast."
See, and that's the thing. So he really wasn't insane by the court. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, he could not be.
Well, and was never found out.
But you know what I mean? He wasn't insane. He knew what he was doing, is my point. Yeah.
He knew it was wrong. Right. He knew what he was doing was wrong. Captain Harry Hegger offers Travis something to drink, and Travis asks for a soda. He finished it and threw the can away. And Captain Harry Hegger, being smart officer there, he took the can to get it tested for DNA. And bingo. Travis's DNA matched the DNA left on Yvonne Cruz and Brenda Beasley's body. Mm-hmm. They had him.
Good.
They got
good.
Him. Well, they at least had the
for those two.
Was
that's all you need.
Women. And since there is semen in the body, semen don't last that long. Yeah. You know what I'm saying? Police also check the tires on his car, and the tread matches the tire marks that were found on Betty James' leg. Too much of a coincidence for it to not be him. So when the interview turned to interrogation, the questions became more in your face, very more direct. Travis requested an attorney, so they had to stop. But Travis did tell them, "I'm not going back to prison." 3 days later, Travis hanged himself in his cell. Now, of course, there is speculation that he had help, kind of like the old Jeffrey Epstein thing. But and only because really he had a pillowcase. He had a pillowcase over his head and his hands were tied behind his back and he had hanged himself. So it's kind of weird.
A little hard to put that on there and then tie. Yeah.
Right. Clayton police and the St. Louis County Medical Examiner agreed that while it was weird, it's still a suicide. And he was supposed to be on suicide watch. And
I think often, though, they're on suicide watch and maybe, just maybe, people kind of tend to look the other way when the crime is so
because they're
horrible.
Son of a bitch. Yeah.
Well, okay. Or that. Whichever way you want to put it.
Well, and there were three of the correctional officers were reprimanded. And I can't tell you the last time that in St. Louis City that I know of that there'd been a prisoner that has committed suicide before.
Yeah, it's been a while.
On suicide watch. I mean, it's odd for St. Louis. It might be not for other places. I don't know. I haven't.
Or maybe we don't even know, though. Maybe they don't even tell us all that either.
That's true.
I don't know. Yeah.
But anyway, it's ruled a suicide. But before he did, he wrote a note to his mother. And of course, it was a suicide note. And in the note, he apologized for any grief that he had caused her or the family. And he said that she was the best mother a man could ever have. He also wrote saying that he had been sick in the head since he was 14 and he had never felt normal or happy at any time of his life. So he's dead, which is very sad. No, but that just, I know it's cruel, but it's very sad because.
Sorry, the way you said that. Okay.
Yeah. But it's sad because there's no closure.
No answers. Yeah.
For anybody.
No answers.
He can't identify his victims, but from what it sounds like on the tape, he doesn't even know their names, so they will never be identified. He said that there was only 17, or this is body number 17, but he's suspected of at least 20. And this is kind of when it gets scary, because they had all
as
this...
As if the rest of that wasn't scary.
I know.
But okay,
but
I know what
me.
You're saying.
As he was dead, but the police had all this evidence of... that they collected from his house, and they were still going over it. In a pile of paper, they came across blueprints that he was using to turn his basement into a big sex dungeon.
Dungeon, yep.
The sketch was for an 8-square-foot area that had 2 cells, each cell being 2 feet wide and having their own doors. And judging by the writings and newspaper clippings found... they determined that Travis had been planning this for 9 years. 9 years. And the newspaper clippings that were found were about Katie Beers. Do you remember this? I do. She was a 9-year-old that had been kidnapped by a family friend in New York. She was a 9-year-old girl from New York State, I believe, and she had been kidnapped by a family friend. And they had held her in an underground bunker for 16 days. And this happened like in 1993. They found her, but still scary.
So he got that idea to keep his
That's where
slave.
He got the idea. Yeah. That he was going to keep him underground.
It happens a lot. People see something and then they're like, yeah, I want to do that.
Police also found rules that Travis had written out. And they were things like, do not talk or scream. Do not touch the doors. There were notes on how to control bigger women. He needed to find quicker ways home from the areas where the sex workers were, like quick routes from the stroll to his house, right? They even found like a shopping list with items. He wanted like 2 pairs of handcuffs. He needed more iron or he needed more leg irons and even a leathered zippered hood. I mean, Travis was planning on home. He was honing his skills, and he was going to become even more than a monster than he already was.
And I hate to say it, like, he had a lot of victims before he was caught. So could you imagine if he got away? Like, that? I can't even.
No.
I've seen some of those videos, and they are beyond horrendous. And I can't even, you asked me, and I can't remember where I saw them from. I do remember a, you know, like an unfinished basement part or the, I guess it's a pipe, a giant pipe. And this girl was handcuffed and like hogtied behind the pipe. And
yeah. I think she was handcuffed. Yeah.
Making her beg and do things like that. And this was like, I think he'd had her like 3 days or something. I mean, it was heartbreaking. She had a kid. And he was using that. Oh, it was terrible.
Yeah, you could find those pictures on the internet. And there's parts of that video on Cold Case
Files.
Cold Case Files. I've got it in the sources because I did watch that. But funny about that house that you're talking about. A little fun tidbit. In 2013, a St. Louis woman sat down one evening to watch a true crime documentary about our friend Maury Travis here.
I know.
When she was watching it, she was shocked when they showed Maury's house because what? That's where she was renting. And she was living there. And it popped up on the screen. And she was shocked. And she's not okay with this. In fact, her two-year-old little family member used to play down in that basement.
Yeah. Could you imagine?
Well, and also an article I found, and you could take this as you will, but she said that little pole that you were talking about where the woman is shown being held.
Yeah.
She said when that little two-year-old got close to that place, just started to cry and wanted to leave for no reason.
That just gave me chills. It's brutal. And you know what? I do have to say, and I could be wrong, but I think when you buy a house, they have to acknowledge, they have to tell you, they have to disclose if anybody was murdered or killed in the house, right?
Well, funny you should say that, because she tried, this lady tried to get out of her lease, claiming that she needed to be, she should have been told, right?
Yes, I think
Missouri
do.
Doesn't have that.
Oh.
That's not a Missouri, you do not have to disclose if there's been a murder or a death in your house. So
look
she
at
could
this
not.
Beautiful 3-bedroom, 2-bath ranch in Ferguson, Missouri. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
It's super cheap and it's so great. And I can see the house because I know what house it is.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I can see
but
it.
But yeah, she could not break, or she could break her lease, but she'd lose all her money.
It. Yep.
But funny thing is, her landlord that wouldn't let her out of the house, the lease, it's Travis's mother, Sandra.
Shut up.
Shut up. Yeah.
So Travis's mom did not divulge to the renter that her son killed people in there?
No. She doesn't have to. She's not legally. What? No.
And she kept it as a rental home? Are you freaking kidding me? Wouldn't she sell that and let somebody rip it out or tear it down?
I don't know who owns it now, but yeah. It's one thing. I mean, his mother's not to blame it any way, shape, or form
for what
Travis did.
Would you? Come on.
I'd wash my hands of it.
You're done. You're done.
But I guess if you need the money and you want to
sell the house, then sell it and sell it saying this is what happened here.
Or blaze the house down, raise it down to the ground, nothing. Set it on fire, torch it, whatever you have to do. And then
he was brutal to those women, you know? Ooh.
Oh, yeah. He tortured them. Like, high tortured them, like, and verbally abusive. And he was a son of a bitch. There's no saying he's not.
Nope.
But yeah. Merry Christmas, everybody.
Yeah. Well, here's my connection to this. And I said I'd say it later. So I had a student teacher of mine. I think it was like 5 years ago. And we were talking because he knew my fascination with true crime. Of course. We were talking about stuff. And he goes, ooh, I got a story for you. So, and I believe it was his sister worked in St. Louis with this guy who shall remain nameless, but now we know. Worked with this guy, and he was kind of creepy, kind of weird, whatever. But, you know, okay. And I guess one day he was acting funny or something, and she kind of commented about it. And he goes, what, do you think I'm a serial killer or something? And it was him. It was Maury Travis. And wow. I mean, see, he knew what he was doing. Totally sane.
He knew it was wrong. And his mom knew he was sick.
Yeah, his mom was never a prostitute, right? Like, that's not why.
As far as I know,
he had that anger.
And trust me, if there is any psychological profile on him, I didn't find it. Because like I said, it was mostly through.
There's not a whole lot out there.
St. Louis.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot out there on him because he killed himself. I think if he would have stuck around, there'd probably be more. But
I'm sure he felt that the sex workers were easy targets and he needed to kill. And who knows if he would have progressed on to others besides the sex workers. And can I tell you, it was this article every time it was always prostitutes because it hadn't changed over to the, you know, the correct term sex workers.
Worker. Yep.
You know, it was and that's shocking to see, like because you're used to now looking at, oh, they were sex workers, blah, blah, blah. And then you're going, you're like, prostitutes, they're prostitutes. It's like, it's so crass.
Prostitute is such an old word, so I don't think it's...
It almost seems crass now.
I just think that us old folks, that's, you know, or other words that we won't say.
I don't know,
right?
In that whole article about the Princess Motel and just how
that's so
five bodies were found there within the year, and police are like, well, we could have a serial killer, but I don't know. And they were all basically in black trash bags.
Right.
And
well, all of that, too, makes me think about the Long Island, the Lisk killer, Long Island serial killer, because it's kind of the seedy motels and the, you know, the no-tell motel, and people go missing and they come in, they go out, and it's, you know, they don't really keep track of that. And that's what these killers, that's what they rely on, you know, that's what they want. So, and you know what?
It's
what better way
sad.
To pick somebody that will go? I mean, honestly, and we've talked about this. You get in a car because you need drugs and you need money. So you will get in a car with anybody if you think that's going to be on the other side. I mean, what? And it's ripe for the picking for them.
And you know, I Googled those poor ladies' names, and there really wasn't anything on them. That article was the only thing that popped up, which is heartbreaking to me that there's not anything more of those murders. I just hate that.
I agree.
Not to be a Debbie Downer, but
it's a murder podcast, Jen. You can be a Debbie Downer.
I know, but still, I just, all those women are just gone. There's nothing
to the killer. They're objects, honestly.
I know.
He doesn't care.
But they're not objects. They're human beings.
Well, of course they're not, but
they were once somebody's baby that they took care of.
It's awful. Well, that was a good one. Terrible.
Yeah.
Terrible.
It was, and like I knew about the dungeon, but I didn't know it had anything about the Katie Beer story.
Yep.
You know, I didn't know that that's what kind of sparked his interest in the dungeon. And like he had quoted, he was going to do all the work himself. And he even had price quotes of the backhoe would cost him $126 a day.
You know, it'd be interesting to see if he ever reached out to contractors to see about that. Could you imagine saying, hey, I was just wondering if I want to make.
Well, he didn't want anybody to know he had the dungeon downstairs, so he was going to do all the work himself.
Ugh. C'est la vie. See ya, buddy.
So anyway, that's the case. That's it.
That's
all we have.
That is the end of our 12 days. We did it. High five.
Woo-hoo!
And today only took, 5 hours to do?
Yeah.
Two hours of episodes.
Two episodes. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's us, anyway, Jen. Thank you guys so much for listening to our series, and thank you so much for listening to our podcasts. We are very, very grateful for you all.
Merry Christmas.
Each and every one of you.
Happy Hanukkah.
Merry Christmas.
Happy holidays. Thank you guys so much for
Happy New Year's.
Being a listener, you know.
And being our friends, for God's sakes. They're our friends.
It means more than you know. That's for real.
Seriously. I'm getting a little teary-eyed here.
I was teary-eyed earlier because the stupid thing finally started working. We had about a 2-hour breakdown on the computer, and when it started working, I literally teared up, but that's okay. Par for us, par for the course, Jen. So, here it is.
That's
and
it.
I can't wait till we start season 3 in January. Is it 3 or 4? Whatever.
It's
Let's
something.
Go 4. 4 sounds okay. So much better. We start season 4 of our True Crime Podcast in January.
January 13th, to be exact. We wish everybody, and I hope you are having a happy holiday and you're with the people that you love the most, yet staying far away to be safe. It's such a shitty year. God, sorry.
We're so
but we hope your holiday
ends.
I hope. Is better.
We're almost out. Yeah. So anyway, with that, we wish you all a great end of 2020 and a fabuloso 2021. Let's do it. Let's ring it in, people. And thank you for being our listeners.
And our friends. We appreciate you.
Until then, remember, lock your doors.
And keep passing by those open windows.
Bye-bye.
Love you. Today's episode was researched and written by me, Jen. For more information about this episode, as well as all other sources, please check out our show notes or the podcast website at ourtruecrimepodcast.com. Our True Crime Podcast is developed and created by the hosts, Jen and Cam.
Original music and audio mix of all our True Crime Podcast episodes is courtesy of Nico Vertese from We Talk of Dreams. You can reach Nico at wetalkofdreams.com. Listener discretion is provided by Edward October from Octoberpod VHS. You can find all of his great works on YouTube. Please make sure to like and subscribe to our True Crime Podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts. We can be reached on Instagram and Facebook at Our True Crime Podcast or on Twitter with the handle at Our True Crime Pod. You can also email us at ourtruecrimepodcast@gmail.com. We would also at this time like to thank our patrons. We would be so lost without you. Thank you so much. And if you would like to help support the show, you can check us out on patreon.com/ourtruecrimepodcast. You can also show your support by leaving a 5-star review on Apple or simply just tell your friends about us. It's that easy. Love ya.
I am so ready.
All right. So there's not. Nope. See, there's our so's again, right?
So we should have a side kicker podcast. The So Podcast.
And whatever's.
And it would just be like us. So Jen, did you hear about so and like conversation mm-hmm. starting with so? Okay, go ahead.
All these women frequented. Is that the right word?
No, that is not
frequented?
The right word.
Why can't I say that now?
There you go.
Frequented. All nope. these women.
Let me hung do out. This.
Agent Jimmy Walker. And this makes me laugh because I just want to say dynamite.
I was just going to say that, but I was like, why dynamite?
Don't want to make fun of his name, but good times. Oh. Yeah. All right. Got that out of my system.
That's
for anybody that doesn't know. If this gets put in the bloopers, there's a TV show with Jimmy Walker and, his key phrase was dynamite. So, and the show, I loved Good Times. I loved it.
Me too. I did too. And guess who? I was going to get into my
Janet Jackson. Pop.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was going to say all that, but I'm not going to.
Janet Jackson starred in it when she was
and her name was what on there? What was her name? Do you
it
remember?
Wasn't D. That was the other show.
Nope. Nope.
What was her
That's
name?
What's happening? Penny.
Yeah.
And she was abused.
Yes.
Her parent, I guess, caregiver. This is way too much information. Burnt her with an iron. So
I remember that.
Then, yeah. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
She's a cute little girl. Anyway, I digress.